Welcome to another episode of Policy Talk. Today we have very interesting guest with us. We have in the past generally talked to policymakers or researchers in policy. Today we are speaking to a futurist who specializes in digitization, and within digitization also he's done both macro views and sectoral views, specifically to banking. We have the celebrated author, Mr. Brett King, with us. Welcome to the show, Brett.
Thank you.
I wanted to start off with your book that came out last year, and it has an interesting title and it has an interesting thesis, which is you are basically proposing that artificial intelligence, rise of technology, loss of jobs, automation is creating a mass of people, and this would fundamentally change governance structures across the world. And you're talking about maybe a rise of the welfare state to a higher degree. Please explain to us the thesis and the macro thesis in this book, and what are you predicting?
Well, you know, I mean, we talk about a number of trends. AI and techno unemployment is obviously one of those chief trends. The other, you know, is the pandemic, and, you know, potentially future pandemics based on climate change with the release of primordial viruses into the wild. Climate change itself is going to be a far greater impact than artificial intelligence, systemically, and inequality is a major problem for the largest economies in the world, particularly the United States. China's obviously tried to tackle it. India, it's a big problem. Australia, where I'm from, inequality is a big problem. When you combine these things, you really need to force a philosophical change in thinking, because the core economics are no longer working. When you have these changes thrust by artificial intelligence and climate change, particularly on the system, let me explain why. The current system, our principle of the way we create wealth distribution is through human capital. And human capital is the mechanism also by which we satisfy demand in the system. Classic economics 101, supply and demand economics.
There are other elements also of it. I mean, besides the human element, there are resource elements, yes.
Right. But today, you know, how we respond to demand increase is we increase human capital participation in the market, right? In highly automated societies of the 2040s and 2050s, that's no longer the case, because those highly automated societies, demand is satisfied through processing cycles, through the application of artificial intelligence and technology. The human factor is less important. So the link between human labor and the output of the economy is broken by artificial intelligence. In fact, some would argue that is the very reason for AI, is to eliminate humans from the workforce. And as we know, capital markets reward companies for taking humans out of the workforce and making it more productive or efficient. Yeah. So the free market has no mechanism to stop the change of employment structure based on the impact that artificial intelligence is going to bring. So these higher levels of sustained higher levels of techno unemployment will either produce one of two effects. Either it will create social unrest and the collapse of society based on unsustainable levels of human employment, human unemployment, or we will have to create something like universal basic income or some other sort of social safety net as our working practices go through this significant change. And that's really the heart of the question. What do we want to, how do we deal with this transition to a highly automated society and removing humans from the essential role of human capital to keep the economy going instead of computers? Then on top of that, you have climate impact. You have 500 coastal cities that by 2050 are going to be affected by sea level rise. The economic impact to cities like Miami, for example, or Calcutta, is going to be measured in the trillions of dollars in terms of economic impact. This will need a response. So the only saving grace potentially from an employment perspective in highly automated societies is actually climate change. That's the only real growth industry that's going to require human capital to respond. But having said that, it's still a core functional change in the way, you know, human labor works at the economy level. The real outcome of this will be that our role of work in the society will dramatically change. UBI will enable people to not have to work to put food on the table. UBI will create a situation where your basic needs are looked after. And there's a very strong argument in 21st century level economies that the, you know, you have to really examine the core principles of economic theory. What is the economy for in a highly automated society? Is the economy to create GDP growth, full employment, good, strong trade balances, low inflation rates, but high GDP growth? Is that the objective of an economy in the 21st century? Well, if it can't provide jobs for people in the economy, then you would say that it's demonstrably failing to provide for the citizens. So the impact of AI and climate change together means that we have to rethink the priority of the economy from market growth to first and foremost looking after the needs of the citizens fully, and then looking at expansion of the economy beyond that in terms of the market, corporations, and so forth. So it's a reprioritization of economic growth to first look after the core needs. And that starts with prioritization around things like sustainability, effective energy management, looking after the health and education of citizens and things like that. So the needs of citizens can be catered for first and foremost. And then you look at growth, and the mission of the markets and corporations as a second priority.
Yeah, I mean, there are several questions here now. I mean, the basic question that do you work for an income or do you work to fill up your productive time? That becomes very important.
Right.
Social unrest will not go away just because you have income. If you have income and if you still have a lot of time, free time in your life, there still will be social unrest or there will be unrest per se in people's life. It may manifest itself into global or society level movements or not. That is debatable, but it will certainly create distress if people don't have work. So while you solve the problem of income through UBI, you don't really solve the problem of time or employment. And is that a concern which would then force a lot of organizations, a lot of countries, therefore, to apply the model of social?
So let me tackle your question. If you look at universal basic income trials that we've already seen, and there's been about 75, 80 of these trials around the world over the last, 7, 8 years, a few interesting things come out of this. One is that under UBI trials, that entrepreneurs, people that create their own business, do so at 300 or 400% higher rates than the general population. So when people don't have to worry about putting food on the table to survive, they're a lot more creative. So this is not about stopping people from working. This is about giving people the choice to do what they're passionate about, what they love. That's one of the mistakes that many economists that argue against UBI make. They argue that people are not going to have work to do. They're going to be sitting on the couch or sitting in the metaverse, and this is going to leave them without purpose. There's absolutely no evidence that that is what's going to happen when UBI is implemented. In fact, we find exactly the opposite. We find people getting much more involved in social community activities that they feel strongly about, in creating new businesses at a higher rate. And just basically doing the type of work that fulfills them, that gives them fulfillment, rather than work that just puts food on the table. So ultimately, the argument is that UBI actually creates a much more healthy form of work in the economy than the current system. So I don't agree that there will be social unrest from universal basic income because people have lost their purpose. I think that they'll have greater purpose with their work focus than we do today.
So, I mean, I always thought that you were a optimist and you're a techno optimist. You classify yourself under that category as a futurist. But the scenario that you're painting is quite you might say dystopian or negative in that sense. The fact that I'm not saying whether
it is a core philosophical shift in terms of economics and the way we think about it, economic system design. Absolutely. And I get that. But I wouldn't say it's dystopian. I would say it requires a philosophical change. But I'll just put it this way, to summarize, is the intention of artificial intelligence, and particularly AGI, artificial general intelligence, has always been to eliminate humans from the workforce. That has always been the intention of AI. And so the argument by economists today either falls into two categories. One, which I'm talking about, UBI and this sort of generalized approach, or an argument that, you know, when we look historically at impacts of new technologies, we've always created new jobs when technologies impact older jobs. Now, the problem with that under the artificial intelligence scenario, under AGI, is that AGI affects so many different types of jobs simultaneously. Accountants, lawyers, doctors, radiologists, truck drivers, pizza delivery people, Uber drivers, et cetera, all simultaneously. And so this is more akin to the Industrial Revolution in terms of its effect on restructuring the economy and the way, work, the role of work in the economy is. So if you look at the Industrial Revolution, prior to this, about 85, 90% of employment was in agriculture, right? Prior to the Industrial Revolution, today it's 1.6% of the workforce is in agriculture in the United States. You know, you have a massive structural.
It's still 40-45% in a place like India.
So. Right. I know. I get that. But this is again an area where automation is going to have.
It's interesting. That's the interesting question. The fact that we've seen the impact of automation on manufacturing. We've seen the impact of an economic system which promoted basically allowing corporates to outsource manufacturing from one country to another. And in a sense, we're seeing the reverse of that now, at least in global economic systems. You're talking about the even for the services sector, the economic system being broken, that per dollar of investment may not generate the same number of jobs as it was doing, 15 years back.
Correct.
And therefore, going forward, you cannot depend upon these services jobs to grow. Furthermore, they will not absorb the loss of manufacturing jobs or the loss of agricultural jobs. So the system is broken in that sense, or it, we're not seeing it because it's still not fully there. But it is. Right. We're seeing it. We're seeing trends of it. Say, for instance, I'll give you one sector which has seen the huge impact of AI, which is the chatbots in the call center. Call center.
Right.
Now, the call center business was huge, as you know, in India, Philippines, and some of these other countries where there is a large English-speaking population. And suddenly, that whole business has changed because of these artificial intelligence-led chatbots, which allow you to do the initial query addressing or initial, support.
And GTP 4 and natural language processing and those sort of technologies probably accelerate that type of shift in the service industry.
So now you can actually have a call, which
there is one massive growth industry that will still be able to provide some employment, or strategic employment, but it's not sustainable enough to create all of the jobs that will change in the economy, and that is climate mitigation. So we're talking about retooling energy grids, installing, solar and wind, renewable installations, battery storage, grid level battery storage, domestic battery storage, rooftop solar in cities, things like that, plus hardening the water system so they're not affected by, increased flooding events, seawall defenses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, hardening infrastructure and making, your economy climate resilient. There is an argument we made in the book that to qualify for long-term universal basic income, that citizens may have to do a couple of years of national service on climate mitigation. This may not necessarily be climate work in India, for example, if you're an Indian citizen. It may be climate work in Bangladesh or, Maldives, areas in the subcontinent that are affected by, in far greater, extent than India per se. And this is going to be a type of international, workforce. How this is managed?
Then they will have to be paid by an international organization if it's international workforce. Can't be paid by a national.
Well, understand this, that in the second half of this century, that some economists argue that more than 50% of GDP will need to be focused on climate mitigation globally. And so the scale of the climate problem in terms of the amount of human effort that we have to expend is extensive. Now, we are going to miss our climate, our carbon goals as a globe, right? That's become fairly clear now. And the more by which we miss those carbon reduction goals, the greater the damage to the ecosystem and the greater the amount of climate mitigation work that's going to happen, particularly in the second half of this century from 2050 onwards. But already by the mid-2030s and by the 2040s, you are going to be seeing trillions of dollars spent on climate mitigation. Now, this requires a fundamental rethink in terms of governance globally in respect to climate response. This needs to become a massive global coordinated response, almost like the effort that you saw globally around, say, the Second World War, in the terms Marshall of mobilization plan. Of economies and things like that, because the scale of this problem is just too large. Let me give you the core elements of this. Estimates are that by 2050, we are going to see somewhere between 300 million and 1.6 billion eco-refugees. These are people displaced by either climate change specifically, so sea level rise, global warming, where the heat becomes untenable for long-term residents. And in addition, food scarcity because of changing farming practices and things like that based on global warming. So you have certain staple crops that won't grow in certain regions anymore, the loss of arable land and so forth.
So these are not economic migrants, but these are climate change migrants.
Right. You
said they're going to be more than the economic migrants.
Absolutely. No. So, you have economic migrants in there as well, but most of this is food scarcity and, climate eco-refugees. So, just take Pakistan, for example. We're talking about 33 million displaced people in Pakistan as of the floods. So if you have these types of floods happening every year, instead of like 1,000-year events or 100-year events that we have, you then have a large mobilization of, these eco-refugees. This year, about 65 million eco-refugees. So the 300 million estimate, it seems very, very low, right? So if you say a billion people, let's say a billion people, that's about halfway, right?
Yeah, that's like an India movie, yeah.
Right. So think about the entire population of India displaced by climate or food scarcity. The argument that we can, you know, who's going to pay for this? Who's going to pay, you know, which economy?
The first thing is that where are they moving? Are they moving global north, global south? Are they moving global east, global west?
Sorry, I lost you for a second there.
Yes.
That's a huge issue, you know, where they're moving. But it doesn't really matter where, because at some point you're going to have to say, well, you can't deny them entry, right? You have to now figure out where to put these people. Because if you deny them entry, a billion people die. And so there's a false equivalency, an argument that, well, who's going to pay for this? Which economies are going to cater for the costs of relief to this group of a billion people? There's no economic equivalent of a human lives at a billion people, right? What's the economic level of which we're willing to accept the loss of a billion lives? You know, at what point does that become reasonable, that saving our economy some money, in order to, and letting a billion people die is reasonable? So this is the core philosophical shift I'm talking about, that the free market economy doesn't have the solutions to fix a problem of this scale while you also have techno unemployment happening at the same time. We are talking about a fundamental shift in the way we think about economics. There's no other way to deal with this other than saying, let's let a billion people die because, you know, we can't afford it. Because, you know, essentially, even if you start funding, you know, climate response at that level and catering for these eco-refugees by building floating cities or creating, massive smart cities to cater for them and things like that. Yeah. At some point, national debt becomes completely unsustainable, right? So, you know, at that point, national debt becomes meaningless because, you know, your national debt may be more than your entire GDP. So you need to think fundamentally differently about this, the response to this problem on a global basis. The tools we have in the current economics just, don't really provide us with a free market mechanism to solving this problem. The scale of the problem is too large.
I mean, but we're not very good at understanding or responding to problems that seem to be happening at a distance. We don't respond very well.
You're right.
At anything that is happening, say, we don't even respond to problems which are happening 10 years or 15 years away.
Quite short term we are we're worried about the next quarter, the next year's results, or maybe the next election cycle. That tends to be the sort of limitation of our focus.
Yeah.
And that is a problem of modern economics and humanity. If you look back at the pre-industrial civilization, Stone Age civilizations, and even, the humans of the Middle Ages, we did tackle massive 50, 100-year projects that had, budgets that extended over those 100 years and commitments, from an artistic perspective that were a lot longer in focus. So, This is a function of capitalism to some extent. It makes us very short term in our focus.
Is it a function of capitalism, or is it a function of our mental frameworks per se, which embed in us the importance of performing short term versus surviving long term?
Well, I think if you think about work practice prior to the Industrial Revolution as an example, one of the problems with short-termism is that, people spent 70% of their time just getting enough food to survive, right? The Industrial Revolution, reduced that problem by, creating better food supply, more consistent food supply and so forth. Hunter-gatherers, went hungry for long periods of time. Agriculture you know, improve that. So there's been a bit of a yin and yang over the eons in terms of this short-term versus long-term focus. But in our current system, the short-term focus is very much aligned with the way we think about budgeting and economic utilization. So again, I think the philosophical change there is a sort of fundamental one.
So, you know, your worldview or the way you're thinking about the future has changed over the last 15 years, you know, from
yes.
Bank 1.0, Bank 2.0, to techno-socialism. And now you're thinking of two mega trends, which are basically collapsing or colliding with each other to create, you know, what somebody would call a perfect storm of, you know, the worst part of the human civilization coming together in the worst possible manner. What prompted this shift in thinking, one? And was there a conscious attempt to shift it towards that kind of thinking, or?
Well, you know, for me personally, part of it was my evolution philosophically, understanding.
Was there trigger to it?
You know, I've always been a futurist. Obviously, the series of books I wrote in the banking space were all future focused. You know, if you look back at Bank 2.0, my first book released in 2010. No, I was projecting what was going to happen in 2015, 2020, 2025 with banking. And we're on track for a lot of the things that I predicted.
Were there any hits then. Any misses?
Well, you know, one example I gave, for example, you know, is I talked about in 2016 that mobile wallets would overtake plastic cards and cash use globally.
Yeah.
So I was off by a couple of years on that one. As you know, Paytm and the you know, unified payment system in India, as well as, you know, what we've seen with the Chinese mobile wallets, M-Pesa, Mobile Money, MTN Money, Kakao, GCash, et cetera, you know, all of these different wallet systems combined in the aggregate now represent about three times the amount of transaction volume annually of plastic cards, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was one where I got the timing off by a couple of years. But, you know, in 2010, when I made that prediction, people thought I was absolutely crazy. They said, are you crazy? Cards are going to be here for the next 50 years. What are you talking about, right?
The cards are still there in that sense. I mean, like, the cards have not...
Right, but...
Usage has gone up dramatically.
Right. But that was not what I was not saying that cards would disappear. I was saying mobile wallets would become the primary bank account, right, for people. And that has happened because, you know, for two reasons. One is digitization, but two is banking the unbanked through the use of smartphones and mobile phones. You know, we could never do that with branches and plastic cards and passbooks, you know, and checkbooks. As the Reserve Bank in India found, when they mandated, you know, that the rural locations, then of branches, you know, back in the 90s when they made that requirement, they learned that, for example, identity infrastructure was a precursor to having branches being effective. But once the Aadhaar card system was created, hey, guess what? You don't need branches. All you need is a mobile phone to do your banking. You know, so that's a great example of sort of that systemic change. But cards will eventually disappear. But the point was clear or not. That's certain.
Sorry, Brett, I had to stop you there. Brett, have I lost you there? So, Brett, you know, the fact that you were quite right on the wallets and the change that wallet has brought about, not just into the credit card or the card business, but also fundamentally into the fact that transactions or payment transactions have moved out of the banking system and moved into the wallet business, so to say. Another fundamental shift that is happening in the banking space is that with the advent of CBDCs, the wholesale banking, or at least the global transaction of wholesale banking, may move out from the banking system into maybe the fintech world. How do you see that happening? What are the so critical factors for it to happen in the right manner?
Well, it depends what time frames you're talking about, but ultimately, you know, by like the mid 2040s, certainly by the 2050s, I expect that maybe half of all economic activity will be essentially black box run by
AI. So we were talking about how CBDCs are going to change the banking scenario and how CBDC are going to change the global fintech scenario. And how long do you think, or what are the critical factors for it to succeed, and how long will it take to succeed if it were to?
Well, so I think over maybe the next 20 years, we're going to see a shift to CBDCs for a couple of core functions of the economy. But there's a couple of different levers here that could change the timing. One is China's CBDC and its connection to the Belt and Road. So if China insists that its trading partners must use the yuan to trade using road supply chain infrastructure.
That's not working very well, I believe. I mean, like that forcible usage is not really attracting a lot of...
No. But I mean, you know, if you are a trading partner with China and they say, we prefer you to use this infrastructure, and you get all these benefits, including access to funding and so forth, I think there's a case for that potentially. CBDCs could also be the mechanism by which we create universal basic income, because it's sort of like a new supply of money, right? So there's a couple of illustrations of where CBDC demand could come from. But keep in mind, the highly automated economies of the 2040s and 2050s must work on smart contracts. That's the mechanism of automation. Yes. And so smart contracts can't use fiat. You need programmable money. So you either need CBDC, stable coins or crypto or tokens, you know, some mechanism. So the more automation we have, the more reliance on the CBDCs we have. And then that means that we are essentially building two pieces of infrastructure, the wallet infrastructure that enables you as a consumer or as a business to conduct commerce and to buy and sell. And the second piece is the market mechanism, which is essentially algorithmic.
So, I mean, the fact that for the first time in human history, you have a currency that is smart enough to be programmable in that sense. It has a memory. It has a. It can accept a smart contract. It can accept both. It can have a memory of its past transaction, and it can even have a memory of its future transactions. In that sense, you know. So that fundamentally changes. Will that bring in, say, global fintech to play in a different way or different manner?
Well, you know, I think Andreessen Horowitz and others have talked about everyone becomes a fintech. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I think we are talking about a fundamental rethink in terms of the core banking infrastructure. You know, to be competitive as a banking system in this world, you have to be able to support the automation. And that's not only automation at the transaction level, but automation at a regulatory level. So, you know, one of the objectives of CBDC is to stop or prevent money laundering, right? But this requires not only programmable money, it requires digital identity schemas, and it requires high levels of automation in terms of regulation. So if you think about the way we manage money laundering today, we stop about 1% of global money laundering using suspicious transaction reporting, the FATF, you know, 40 rules, and all of those mechanisms that we have. We are woefully poor at stopping money laundering globally based on the current tools that we have. But if we treat money laundering almost like a cybersecurity threat, you know, how we do network security or ransomware and so forth, and we build, you know, tracking of suspicious actors into the system, which CBDC will reinforce, then we can cut suspicious actors out of the payments networks and reduce money laundering and things like that. You know, so governments, you know, the reason they're trying to use CBDCs is obviously automation, but there are side benefits like the traceability of money and the programmability of money for specific uses and specific scenarios. So, you know, you could give someone a CBDC as their universal basic income, and you can say you can't use the money for gambling, right? Yeah. But you can use it for healthcare, for rent, for electricity, for food, and things like that. Now, some people might cry afoul of that and say, why do you care what I use my UBI for? And over time, I think the UBI will just become that, you know, just income you can use however you like. But there will be some experimentation with this sort of programmability of money and its application at a social level too, I think. But it comes down to this. You can't have smart economies with fiat currency. So we have to move towards programmable money of some type.
So that would mean the end of crypto as a currency, and in a sense, the decentralized finance is getting centralized, more centralized.
Not necessarily, you know, because you are going to have competing systems. You're also going to have bartering. AIs are going to be trading time and trading hours and trading utility based on a token sort of economy that's created between AIs. And we may not have much control over that. It may be a black box, a function of AI marketplaces. For example, you know, a self-driving Uber vehicle, right, that's operating in the economy has to acquire electricity or energy to keep the vehicle charged, because it'll be an electric vehicle. And so how does it pay for that electricity? Well, it could trade hours driven in the vehicle for access or for paying road tolls or things like that, a type of bartering mechanism. And in smaller ecosystems, sort of self-contained closed-loop systems, crypto will work very well. And could be a competitor against sort of mainstream CBDCs. So I don't think it's an either or. I think it's, I think we're going to have a significant level of complexity of these autonomous supply chain contracts and things like that, that will involve multiple different types of programmable currencies. I don't think it's CBD or crypto. I don't think that's a arguable stance, frankly.
Let me take you back again to the macro world. You know, when you look at the whole digitization trend, and because you've studied it so deeply, both in the banking and the fintech space, what are the similarities that you're seeing of digitization in other sectors? You've talked about health, logistics, global trade. How is digitization trend shaping in these sectors?
So, you know, I mean, healthcare is a great example. It's extremely inefficient in countries like the United States. India has seen some improvement in healthcare over the last couple of decades, but as the economy becomes more affluent, of course, the total cost of healthcare in the system has grown. You know, so. In the US, it's about 16% of GDP, 17% of GDP. In most of the other developed G20 nations, it's maybe 7 or 8% of GDP. Yeah. So the US is particularly bad at healthcare because of their privatized model. And that creates a massive administrative cost demand or a load in the middle of the system that's extremely inefficient. Whereas nationalized healthcare systems or centralized healthcare systems tend to perform better economically. The US pays twice the OECD average for healthcare outcomes, you know, and so we can address that through technologies like artificial intelligence that is better at diagnostics. You know, we have about 40% of diagnosis in healthcare in India and China and the United States today, you know, the largest economies in the world, about 40% of diagnostics are wrong. So AI will address that gap. In the US, about 40% of 40% of the costs of the system are administrative costs. Whereas, with national healthcare systems like, in the UK, it's it's about 3 or 4%. So AI, robotic process automation, will dramatically improve that. Gene therapy will eliminate many of the conditions that we have over the next 20 years, because instead of treating Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or breast cancer, or, you know, these genetic germline diseases, we will be able to effectively eliminate these diseases from the genome using gene therapy. As well as that, you know, we will have new technologies like better bio sensors and trackers, 3D bioprinting, you know, all these advances in medicine could dramatically reduce the cost of healthcare. But the way you get those efficiencies of scale is these massive data pools, right? So actually economies like India and China, because of their large populations, may have an advantage here on a data basis to improve to move to sort of some subscription based healthcare model that's much more focused on preventative medicine and overall, you know, health regimes in terms of keeping you healthy, than the current system, which is designed essentially to use medicine and treatment as a profitability mechanism, right? So again, this is part of the sort of philosophical shift around healthcare being a core responsibility of the economy rather than a mechanism for creating profits for a certain sector of the economy, right? So that's one area. Education is another area that goes through massive changes. You know, you have the ability to have very high quality distributed education based on technologies like virtual reality and just access to digital effectively that can improve the quality of education more broadly. I think education will be a mix of classroom and digital application. And we'll do a lot more storytelling and role playing and you know, situational scenario building for education than we do sort of learning by rote to fill standardized tests and things like that. I think education will be highly customized for each you know, personality and psychological profile and capabilities that each individual student has and so forth. Energy management and resource management at a city-state level will be dramatically changed by automation. So, there's really not an industry I can think of that doesn't get affected by these, high-level technological automation changes at a society.
Let's come to the third part of our conversation, which is basically structured around three important parts. One is your learning system and your learning process. How do you learn?
I do a lot of reading of things like scientific articles that help me to better do trending analysis in terms of development of core technologies. So, for example, you know, gene therapy. I track the advances in gene therapy. I'm not obviously a geneticist. I can't understand the mechanisms in the same level of detail as a geneticist, but I can understand enough about those things to sort of track the major improvements that we're making in those arenas that are likely to affect commercialization or implementation.
Is there a tool that you use for tracking these trends?
So, Twitter's a very strong part of that because I'm able to curate the people I follow that can give me those news sources. As well as that, I have tailored a number of Google searches with specific terms and so forth that will feed me breaking news in particular segments on particular topics, like, for example, when it comes to fusion energy or, asteroid mining or whatever, I'll have certain triggers around that. Also the work I do on the podcast, I run a couple of world leading podcasts. So one is obviously Breaking Banks, which is the number one global fintech podcast. And then I run one called The Futurist, which is a newer podcast, but that's in, again, in the top 1% of podcasts globally. And so I'm constantly interviewing thought leaders in the space, both from a banking and financial services perspective and general, futurist trends. So transhumanists, robotics, AI specialists, you know, et cetera. And so I learn a lot through that process, of recording and conducting those interviews as well. It's a great source of information. So there's a few, but I do, you know, like as a futurist, sci-fi can't be understated either. Science fiction is a big part of my learning curve, in terms of understanding the zone of probability. Sci-fi tends to look at a lot longer, 10,000 years and things like that. And so it's a good way to imagine some of these changes that might take place.
So what is the process you adopt for thinking or imagining, as you were saying? Or are these two different processes?
Some of that is just sitting around the campfire, so to speak, and musing on these things. Others is interviews like this, where, as I'm challenged or asked questions, I'm connecting the dots of information that I'm learning and processing that, and articulating that in a particular way. So a lot of it actually is this creative process. Of course, writing the books, you have to also come up with a thesis. You have to prove or disprove the thesis or do the best you can to do that. So the writing process also fleshes out a lot of this thinking. So I would say it's a number of mechanisms, but it's the synthesis of the data into a narrative that happens naturally through the work I'm doing that gives me my broader, if you like, policy outcomes.
So I don't know, does walking or does walking anywhere help you in that thinking process? Do you do any conscious note taking, audio or text?
I do take some notes. And I use both notes on my phone and computer, as well as handwritten notes on occasion. Mainly I'll be, so when I'm planning a new book, I will be taking a lot of notes around the different topics that I'm going to tackle in the book sort of collect those at various times. When I look at the book plans that I'm doing for various books, I'm structuring the areas that I want to research on. And then sometimes, by the end of the book, I've seen some changes in that structure based on the information I've learned.
Do you do structuring in paper or on digital?
Both. Mainly digital, but sometimes on paper. Just, for example, if you look at the four scenarios that I create for the rise of techno-socialism, the potential outcomes in terms of macro system design, in terms of policy setting and economic, that was a whiteboard session I did with my co-author, Richard Petty. And we sat there and did it on a whiteboard, and we basically used two axes, right? Inequality versus inclusion, utopian versus dystopian, or planned futures versus unplanned futures. And we mapped out various possibilities and came up with four macro scenarios, right? So that was a brainstorming session on a whiteboard over a couple of days, using a lot of different economic papers and things like that as support for the thesis, right?
And do you adopt any process for creativity?
On creativity?
Yeah.
Well, there are certain environments where I'm more creative, particularly when it comes to writing. And that is that I write at coffee shops, right? And that seems the most effective mechanism for me. I know other writers write differently. Some writers prefer to write at home. I'm friends with an amazing author, Kevin J. Anderson, who writes in the junior and so forth, for example. And Kevin writes while he hikes. He dictates to a voice recorder, and then someone writes that down afterwards. But for me personally, the white noise, and the activity at a coffee shop helps the creative process for me personally. That's just something I found over the years.
Interesting, interesting. I will send you a very interesting link about a course that I am preparing, basically on learning, thinking, and creativity. And one of the interesting insights in that is that white noise or meditative music can actually help in connecting long neurons. So, correct. And it can actually help you access long-term memory and connect it in various different ways. So, people have tried doing that consciously. And one of the ways that they found doing it consciously is by walking on that thought. So,
yeah, I do. The other thing that I do as part of my career, of course, is in any year, I'm doing somewhere between 15 and 25 countries that I'm visiting on the speaking circuit. You know, I speak around the world. And so when I'm traveling, walking through airports and on aircraft, I get a lot of time to think and have that synthesis. But you're absolutely right. There is some really interesting psychological research coming out about, walking and physical activity and neurogenesis, associated with that. So it's actually a very good time to do creative work is after you've done some exercise, for example, yeah. Because it forms, stronger, neuro connections and so forth. And the white noise is a mechanism we're starting to understand, as you say, that is better for that sort of subconscious synthesis. So there is some real scientific evidence behind this, for sure.
Yeah. Both Daniel Kahneman and others have actually done a fair bit of research on the noise element or the music element, whichever way you want to classify it. Some people actually classify white noise under music, especially Brian Eno and all. No, they
generally have both, right?
Yes. But the interesting thing about that music is that it does not engage you fully, in the sense that you don't have to be engaged with it to listen to it. So therefore, the rest of the mind can actually work on the thought that you were originally occupied with. So that's very interesting. I have observed that in my own writing and work that helps a lot, especially when you are stuck with a headline or a particular idea that you want to kind of completely reinvent or represent. So I used it once in a article where I compared crypto with Kardashian, Kim Kardashian. And I said that, both of them are very similar to each other because both of them do not have any inherent talent or inherent asset value. But they thrive on trade and being seen. So,
well, you could argue the US dollar is the same, right?
No, but the US dollar is still a ledger which the government guarantees. I mean, the government might be bankrupt.
I mean, it's our trust in government that yes. Government is a viable mechanism of value that allows us to underwrite. There are plenty of examples, even during the Depression with the US dollar, where yes. The government's ability to underwrite a currency didn't really mean anything.
Absolutely. It's a fiat currency, it's a paper currency at the end of the day. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Brett. That was very interesting. Grateful to you for your time.